You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 10th of July, 2024, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. And as usual, we'll be talking about some of the more interesting construction industry news that's emerged over the past couple of weeks. But there's really only one big story to discuss, isn't there, Phil? Would you like to guess what it might be?
The bloody weather. 10th of July, you just said. And it's raining.
I know. Actually, the sun's just come out, yeah, so... Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's the big story. But let's talk about something a little bit more appropriate, shall we?
You want to talk about the new dawn has broken. We have a Labour government with a stonking majority. Indeed. More than half the House of Commons have a new MPs. There's a lot of
that's astonishing,
inexperience,
isn't it?
Yeah. In there.
Have you got a new one, Phil?
Yes. We have, the Weald of Kent constituency, a new constituency, and a newbie, but she's one of the few Tories.
Oh, right, okay. Well, I suppose we
will. How about you? Have you got a new MP?
Yeah, we're back with the Lib Dems.
Of Devon's Lib Dem, isn't it?
Well, it is. I think maybe Exeter is Labour. Yeah, I think Exeter's still Labour. I don't know. But yeah, North Devon is back with the Lib Dems. We've had a couple of...
A lot of yellow on the map in the West Country.
Yeah. Well, it's traditional down here, isn't it? I don't know why. But so there we are. That's all changed. But I suppose, talking about all change, of course, that's Keir Starmer's rallying cry, isn't it? You know, we're going to have change. Everything's going to change and get a lot better, according to Keir. So what about the construction industry? I think it's generated quite a lot of excitement in the construction sector. People think there's going to be loads more work and more house building and all the rest of it. Do you think that they're right to be excited?
I think it's obvious that they're going to be excited. The entire strategy policy of the new government is to go for economic growth. Mm. And that is all predicated on house building, on construction in general and house building in particular.
Yeah.
The first speech that the Chancellor Rachel Reeves gave Monday morning after moving into a new office in the Treasury was basically saying, NIMBYs, get out the way. We're going to say yes to everything. All these projects that are stalled, we're just going to say yes to everything. And it's, as far as the construction industry is concerned, they're going to say, this is absolutely great. This is just what we've been asking for. They've been saying, we talked about in previous podcasts how they want to, construction industry leaders want the politics taken out of planning and out of construction and out of infrastructure. But I I don't think this is going to take the politics out of anything.
No.
Saying yes to everything and, you know, big new housing developments and data centres and onshore wind turbines, it may be what we need, but there are going to be, very rapidly, there are going to be by-elections lost by the Labour Party as soon as NIMBYs start complaining, frankly. Yeah. I hate this. I mean, it's a lovely acronym, NIMBYs, not in my backyard. And it's a very derogatory term for, you know, people who are presumed to be selfish and looking out for their own narrow self-interest. And the Labour Party is the Labour government's view is that we're not, you know, it's not about political interest, it's not about self-interest, it's about national economic interest. But, I mean, you and I have talked about this before. I know you reckon you're not particularly a NIMBY, but I will freely admit that, I mean, I moved into a beautiful Kent village 25 years ago, and it used to take me 5 minutes to drive into my nearest town and 10 minutes to get to the motorway. Now, if I'm lucky, it can take me 20 minutes to get into town and 40 minutes to get to the motorway.
Yeah.
Simply because all the housing development has gone on all around. Now, it's great that lots more people have got houses, and, you know, I would hate to, and obviously it sounds like I'm saying I don't want people to have houses. I acknowledge that. But frankly, I don't really want it all done in my backyard.
Well, no, I mean, I, I, I wouldn't actually say that I wasn't a NIMBY. I mean, I am literally a NIMBY because there is a brownfield site right next to my house, an old tannery yard, which has been actually derelict for the best part of 50 or 60 years. And I'd love somebody to build some houses on it. But rather like you, even in the sleepy North Devon, there's been an enormous amount of house building going on. Road improvement work as well, in order to accommodate all the new housing. And the roads are congested. It takes ages to get anywhere these days. And, we aren't going to be alone. There are going to be lots of people who feel much the same, that they've what was once the green and pleasant land and the surrounding countryside that they've cherished for so long is being built on. My worry is not so much the housing, because I appreciate that we really need the housing, but it's the thing which really gets my goat is the solar farms, energy farms, which are springing up on prime agricultural land, which are, I think, extremely unsightly. And I worry that maybe a strengthened and emboldened Green Party will force the Labour Party to not only build more wind turbines on land around the country. And I don't mind wind turbines so much. I disagree with people who think they're ugly. I think they're rather elegant. But I really don't like solar farms. So is it each to their own? That's what's going to upset me if people start building more solar farms in North Devon.
But I don't understand why solar farms have to be put on agricultural land when there's gazillions of big sheds. And why aren't all these data centres being built with solar farms on top? Maybe they are, I don't know. But there's plenty of built environment that we can put solar farms on, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think there's quite a strong movement to encourage that. But it doesn't happen. You know, farmers are nothing if not canny, and if they can see a paycheck looming on the horizon, they'll grab it. And they don't have a sentimental attachment to the countryside. It's a business for them, so they'll sell off their pasture in order to get some green energy instead. But anyway, we're going off at a tangent. We really ought to talk about what Rachel Reeves is planning. Actually, you talk about NIMBYs. We've got a new housing minister, a man called Matthew Pennycook, who I heard on the radio recently. He sounded like a very very sensible, very intelligent man, very pleased to say. I saw a headline, I think, in the Telegraph saying, is Matthew Pennycook a NIMBY? I didn't read the article because of the Telegraph paywall, but I don't think he is a NIMBY because, as you say, that's just not the Labour way of doing things.
Well, I did read that article, and apparently the story goes, and it seems quite well sourced because he actually put the stuff on his own in socials, but only 2 or 3 years ago or so, he, as a local MP, lobbied the local council in Greenwich to stop the developer UNI's plan for four towers between 21 stories and 36 stories high on Greenwich Peninsula. Now, as you know, Greenwich Peninsula is the most brownfield site, which has been had an awful lot of work done since the Millennium Dome and all of that to make it buildable on. And there's been lots and lots of development there. Most of it is not that high. Maybe it goes up to, I don't know how many stories, 15 stories or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he was making the point that these towers are too high for that location. But that does make him sound a bit like an NIMBY, but that's the job of a local MP is to...
Well, of course, yeah.
Air the views and the concerns of local people. Mm. But that's exactly the kind of conflict... They're going to come into with there'll be Labour MPs in their own constituencies having controversial developments going ahead. And they've Rachel Reeves has said, sorry, nothing's going to stand in the way of economic growth.
Yeah.
And this development in Greenwich, they said it was going to, the developers were saying, well, it's going to create about 1,000 jobs and it's going to be a massive motor for the economy. And the new planning minister said, nope, don't want it. So they're going to have to learn to hold their tongue and swallow their, you know, other anti-development instincts and just say yes to everything. And I do kind of think we had a little bit of this with, as Private Eye readers will know, with the Teesside Development Corporation, some suggestions of people getting rich on the taxpayers' expense with, you know, the developers. And there's going to be a lot of deals with developers I think private eye is going to have a field day, frankly, with an awful lot of developments which will go ahead in the race for growth and let's, you know, full steam ahead, go, go, go. There are going to be a lot of... I'll say no more than private eye are going to have a field day.
Yeah.
I think that's clear enough.
Well, that who's the mayor of Teesside? Houchin, isn't it?
Ben Houchin.
Ben Houchin, yeah. He was on the radio as well. Welcoming the new Labour government and its policies. He is the chap who, of course, has been at the butt of all the private eye allegations about, you know, well, he's a Tory mayor for a start, and he oversaw the sell-off of was it Europe's biggest brownfield site to developers who pocketed loads and loads of money, and nothing's been built on it yet. But he was defending that. He said this is the sort of thing that we ought to do and probably can do underneath the Labour administration. Yeah, he also said that, you know, it's delivered. I can't remember exactly how his argument went, but it's delivered a lot of opportunity to people in Teesside and lots of inward investment and that kind of thing.
But whatever the rights and wrongs of the Teesside deals that were done are, I think the point is there was a real hunger amongst local and national politicians to show that things are happening, that perhaps deals which were a bit favourable to the private developers were allowed to slip through and the taxpayer may not have got the best deal. And we no longer have an audit commission. The National Audit Office is purely to police, financial watchdog for central government departments. Councils no longer have a financial watchdog, which is a real issue, in my view. I think they need to either revive the Audit Commission or widen the remit of the National Audit Office, because there will be lots of these deals that will be going uninvestigated, unaudited, and that's a concern, I think.
Yeah, I think it probably is.
Going back to Matthew Pennycook, we were talking about, the new planning minister, what's interesting about him, I notice, is that, I mean, I've never particularly known anything about him, because for a long time, up until about 2 years ago, the Labour Party were irrelevant. And Matthew Pennycook's been in Parliament since 2015. Not only is he the planning minister, he's the MP for Woolwich and Greenwich, or Greenwich and Woolwich, I'm not sure where around it is. And he is the successor as MP there to Nick Rainsford, who is a very familiar name should be a very familiar name to the construction industry, because he was one of the unusually long-serving housing minister in the last Labour government. Yeah. Had the same constituency and the same responsibilities, broadly speaking. And he was very much involved with legislation to reform piloting legislation. The 96...
The Construction Act. Do you mean the Construction
96
Act?
Construction Act?
Yes, yes.
I'm trying to think. No, yes. That was back in the Tory days, wasn't it? 96?
Actually, 97. Yes.
But he was involved in that. It's a driver of that. And I think he was seen as on the side of the construction industry and as a good guy and was appreciated. And Matthew Pennycook seems very much, you know, the heir to Rainsford, both locally and nationally, which I think is quite interesting. And it makes me wonder we don't yet know whether the Labour government is going to keep the Construction Leadership Council, which was a Tory government construct. But if the Construction Leadership Council is to continue within the Department for Business, it's supposed to be the government side co-chair would be a minister from the Department for Business and Trade, or whatever it's called, Business and Industry. But it seems to me that if Matthew Pennycook is going to be the new Nick Rainsford, we want him on the Construction Leadership Council. But whether his department want to take responsibility for the Construction Leadership Council away from the Department for Business, I don't know. So there's some thinking to be done there.
Yeah.
My other final comment on this is I was delighted to see that one of the first things Angela...
Rayner.
Rayner here.
Yeah.
I get confused. Rainsford.
Yeah, exactly.
I keep wanting to call her Angela Lansbury, who's someone completely different. Angela Rayner. She is a deputy prime minister, and when she got the job, she was named as Secretary of State at the Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities. I thought, oh, God, they're giving her that job title. Can't they, you know, surely, for heaven's sake, they're going to rename the department. Mm. And it wasn't till Monday, 3 days later, she came. Yeah, she gave a speech to her staff in the ministry. Said, changing the name, folks. We're not the Department for Levelling Up anymore. We're now the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government, which is what it had been before. Mm. So we're back to being the Ministry of Housing, which is so much more sensible.
Well, it makes sense. Because Levelling Up was a Boris Johnson invention, wasn't it? It was... Or was it Gove who coined that phrase? But it was very much a Johnson legacy, wasn't it?
Having said that, she did, Rayner in her speech to staff, did use two classic Toryisms, which is embarrassing. Oh, yes. We're going back to basics, she said. No more government by gimmick, no more stunts and spin. We're going back to basics, which is an unfortunate, or came to be an unfortunate... slogan for John Major. Mm. And she's also using the phrase take back control. We're going to take back control. And in fact, they're calling it the Take Back Control Act, which is going to give local regional mayors more power for planning and delivery. So take back control is what they're giving to mayors. So back to basics and taking back control are in, and levelling out is... As a leveling slogan up. Is out, although yeah, the aspiration, sorry, levelling up, yeah. The aspiration is still there.
Yeah. They're not actually going to call it the Take Back Control Act. I mean, surely that's just a nickname. I mean, it'll have
Well, in her speech is a capital T, capital B, capital C, Take Back Control Act.
That is strange.
That's how it was presented. We'll see.
Yeah, I would have thought of that slogan was tainted, but never mind. We'll see how it works out.
I had one other observation. When I was looking, I said before, I didn't really know much about Matthew Pennycook, so I looked at his bio on the government website, and it said Matthew Pennycook is the Minister of State for Housing and Planning. Mm. They were elected MP for Greenwich and Woolwich in 2015. I thought, they were elected? That was interesting. I thought, So I started looking at other biographers, and... This is on the gov.uk, the government website for the ministers. I thought, this is interesting. Is this government policy, or is Matthew Pennycook
is that his
pronouns? Pronouns are important these days. Is he a they? Or are they a they? And I looked it up, and I found that this phrase, they were elected... Member of Parliament for whatever the seat, they were elected. It was attributed to, I looked at Pat McFadden, Jonathan Reynolds, Lucy Powell, Ed Miliband, John Healy, and even Rachel Reeves. They were elected MP in such a year. And I was fascinated by it. And I thought, maybe this is what does the new way. Maybe government is gender neutral now, gender neutral language. Just as we have chairs and access chambers rather than chairman and manhole, etc.
Oh, yeah.
maybe he and she just is not exact. And I looked at Keir Starmer. I thought, oh no, he's a he. He was elected. David
he's
Lammy's
the daddy,
a he.
That's why.
Yvette Cooper and Angela Rayner, they were both she.
Oh,
so I was very confused. But lo and behold, a few days later, I looked again and they'd all been changed to he's or she's, and the they's had gone.
I suppose so otherwise, it would seem that anybody below sort of cabinet minister level has been neutered in some way.
Well, no, Rachel Reeves was a they.
Okay.
But I think we've spoken about this before. You do get in job titles in companies, one of the first things I do when I receive a press release and sub-editing it is taking out all the stupid rogue capital letters that people put in there, including putting their names in capital letter.
Yeah.
And this sort of shout at you. Our name is Shouty Capital Letters. And a lot of people have like managing director, capital M, capital C, chief financial officer, all, you know, capital C, capital F, capital. But if it's like a site manager, oh no, you're just a site manager. You don't have capital letters.
All lowercase. Yeah.
All lowercase. So it depends how senior you are, so you deserve capital letters. Yes. So you're suggesting things like you have to be sufficiently senior to have your gender revealed. But no, that's not what it is. So I don't know whether that was an error or whether they'd outsourced it to some far off country where they didn't automatically know whether the names Rachel or John signified gender.
Well, let's hope not.
And made
let's
no assumptions. Not.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
Anyway, that's been adjusted, which completely by the by. But I suppose the newspapers didn't pick on. I would have thought the Daily Telegraph, the Daily Mail would be all over
You'd
that.
Think so. You would
woke,
think so.
Woke culture wars and whatever. But no, they didn't touch it.
Oh, well. There was one other thing which I noticed about, and I know that the Labour Party had trailed this already. We knew they were going to do it, but they say that they're going to appoint 300 more planning officers, getting back to the planning changes. And I just, am I alone in thinking that 300 really isn't very many that we need?
No.
If they really want to achieve what they say they want to achieve, they ought to perhaps beef up planning departments a bit more than just, I mean, I don't know how many local authorities there are in the country. Maybe there's.
Well, in England, there are about 340.
Oh, right. Okay.
That's not including,
so it's not even
Scotland,
one each.
Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that all. Are they all planning authorities? Well, you've got two tiers. There may only be one tier that needs them. Although I think they do different things.
Okay.
I mean, for where I live, for example, I think Maidstone is for building control, and for highways would be Kent County Council. So
oh, I see. Yes, of course. Yeah.
So there's two sides there. But I do strongly have the impression that the logjam in planning is not NIMBYs and opponents and appeals.
Hmm.
It's lack of planning officers.
Yeah.
So I think they need 3,000 rather than 300.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe they'll do that and we just won't notice. But okay. There's lots to keep an eye on anyway.
Right, moving on. What should we talk about next, David?
Well, I think, as ever, climate change and net zero is never going to get, well, it's not going to go away for a long time. Still very much a preoccupation in the construction industry. And there was one story which you broke last week, which I thought was quite interesting, which was about crane hirers, specifically crane hirers. You can tell me if other people are affected as well, complaining about machinery malfunctions caused by diesel additives. In fact, AdBlue is known as. Is AdBlue a generic term or is it a trademark? I don't know. But anyway, it's AdBlue that they're all pointing the finger at, causing breakdowns in mobile cranes particularly. And I thought this was very interesting because I was rather late to this because I drove a petrol car, didn't drive a diesel car, and I never had to put AdBlue into a vehicle until I bought a camper van, and then I had to put it in. And I thought, what a faff. And this stuff is disgusting. I mean, anybody who's had to pour AdBlue into that little spout next to their diesel tank will know that if you spill it, it's horrible. It stains your paint. It gets all over your clothes. Really nasty stuff. And you've got to keep topping up this little tank. And if you don't, you get dire warnings that your vehicle will actually stop dead and won't run. And I think this is probably what's been happening with these mobile cranes, that they've been either conking out or in some other way, sort of lack of power or something like that, failing to perform. So it's a European, isn't it the European Crane Hire Association or something like that is starting to investigate this?
It's an organisation called ESTA, which used
That's
to be
right.
The European Special Transport Association. It used to be the really big heavy haulage, which started because if you're moving a wind turbine or some huge, some big load which involves shutting roads, and you're travelling it, and particularly if you're driving from, across the border in Belgium and into Netherlands or whatever, they needed a pan-European organisation so that the licensing, the ticketing regime for moving a big load cross national borders could move without having to fill in a million different forms. And that was the origins of this organisation, ESTA. And then the big train hire companies realised they faced exactly the same problem. Said, can we join you too? And now it's not just special transport, it's also crane hire. So right, suddenly okay. The ESTA acronym doesn't work for what the organisation is, but it's still called ESTA.
Right, okay.
So they call it ESTA, the European Crane and Heavy Haulage Organisation.
Right, I got it. Okay, or whatever. Yeah, fine.
So anyway, they, this is at a European level, have been getting a lot of reports of from the crane people that they're having problems with their blue. And I thought, right, well, if we're going to go any further with this, we need to get a handle on what the scale and the problem is. So they have simply put out a survey, and this is what my story is. They've got a survey seeking data. Please could everyone who's got, you know, cranes or heavy haulage vehicles go to the survey and share their experience so that ESTA can collate all this information. So they say, right, now we know what's going on. Now we've got a complete picture. There's a real big problem here. At the moment, it's only anecdotal.
Right.
And so I ran this piece simply saying that there's a survey going on because there's a lot of reports of AdBlue issues. And within 15 minutes of me posting that, a chap called Nick Higgins from Monmouthshire-based Raptor plant said, yeah, that's the problem with us. It's not just cranes. I run a mix of Hitachi, Case and Komatsu excavators, and they all suffer with the AdBlue issues. I reckon 50% of all my machine downtime in my excavators is down to AdBlue problems. So while it was the crane people who have sort of flagging it up and trying to get data and info and background on it all, for this one, he cannot be alone. It must be happening everywhere. Has the problem with excavators. Now, maybe people have been not shouting about it because they're embarrassed. They think it's their fault and they're stupid and they don't know what they're doing. But clearly, there's a big issue here with AdBlue, which has been around for ages. I'm amazed it's taken so long to come to my light anyway.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it has been around for ages. I mean, I think this Nick Higgins chap said he's been sort of struggling with this problem for 8 years. And, you know, it is, I suppose it sounds simple. You just have to top up this little tank. And it doesn't take an awful lot, about, sort of, I don't know, a couple of gallons of this stuff into a tank, and it lasts for thousands and thousands of miles. But my van would tell me how many thousands of miles I've got to go before I need to top it up again. And and if it got too low, so I only had, say, like, I don't know, 1,000 miles before the AdBlue tank ran out, then I'd be pestered by my van's computer to, you know, pull over and fill up the tank again. And I've sold the van, actually, and I'm very glad I've sold the van to pay for my new roof. But, you know, it was just a pain in the arse. And if you're running a fleet of diesel-powered vehicles, it's just one extra thing, and it's particularly an annoying thing to have to do. It always struck me, actually, as a bit of a bodge. You know, you've got a diesel engine and it belches out all these nasty chemicals. But if you use this additive, which I suppose is just squirted into the exhaust at, you know, very small quantities, it converts, some sort of chemical magic goes on, and it converts all the nasty chemicals into something like water and
it converts nitrogen oxide into nitrogen and water.
Yeah, there we
That's
are.
What it does.
Yeah,
it,
you can't argue
it breaks
with that.
Up the nitrogen oxide.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing if you don't put it in, and you could live with your dashboard telling you that you needed to put it in, or you ignore that, or you could switch that off in some way. If you didn't put it in, you'd just have smellier emissions.
No.
But your engine would still work. Is that
no,
right?
No. It'll stop. I don't know whether or not that's something which is programmed into the engine's computer, but definitely, according to Volkswagen, if you run out of AdBlue, your engine will not start. You're not going anywhere.
Are there certain rules as to when you should put it in? Does the engine have to be hot or cold? Or
no, I don't think so. I mean, usually it's just a little, you know, a little blue spout next to the black spout, and under the same filler cap. And yeah, usually you get this stuff in, I don't know, gallon. Four liter, you know, cans, plastic cans, with a pathetic flexible spout that always leaks, And you feed this thing into the spout and then just fill it up. And it says you've got to put in at least this amount and no more than that amount. So you've got to get the exact amount right. So you feed this little spout into the filler cap and it goes all over your paintwork. And then you're left with about, you know, a litre of it in the bottom of this can. You've got to carry it around with you and you can't get rid of it. It's just a real faff. It's a pain in the ass. And I just thought that this has got to be a temporary fix, that, you know, you've got to develop engines which don't need this stuff in them. And in fact, I think some plant manufacturers do. Or I might be getting confused with diesel particulate filters, because I know people like JCB, which designs and manufactures its own engines, they always say, you know, you don't need a DPF with our engines. They're nice and clean. But they might still need AdBlue. I don't know about that.
No, I have it in my mind that... here's us talking about stuff we don't know about, because we don't buy cranes and excavators. We simply receive information, edit it, and put it out there again. But I have it in mind that there are engines which, and whether it's the Stage 5 engines or what, I don't know, but there are engines which don't need AdBlue. I don't think AdBlue is required for everything.
Well, there we are. You see, maybe the technology has solved that problem, and that AdBlue actually was just a temporary fix while people, you know, so that existing engines could meet, you know, the new European emissions codes and that kind of thing. But certainly, if it's had its day, then great. I'm sure I'm with Nick Higgins. I think that it's horrible stuff. It's a pain in the arse, and if it's causing vehicles and equipment to break down or malfunction, then clearly it's a big problem. And as you say, it's the only surprising thing is that we haven't heard about this until now.
So if anyone listening's had AdBlue problems or had no problems because you know how to use it properly and you're doing something right and you want to share some information, but if you've got anything to report on this topic, podcast at theconstructionindex.co.uk. We want to hear about it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Have we got an unfinally, Phil?
We do have an unfinally. I got out of the office for on a rare trip out to a not exactly a site, to a steel fabrication yard at Sittingbourne.
Ooh, you lucky
on Monday
bugger.
This week.
Okay.
I went to see a prototype of a railway footbridge. It is called the AVA, A-V-A, the AVA footbridge. And it's a consortium of various people, including Walker Construction, architects Hawkins Brown, and Expedition Engineering. And Expedition Engineering is consultancy headed by a guy called Chris Wise, who I first met him, certainly spoke to him, I think I met him, about 30 years ago when he was a up-and-coming star structural engineer at O'Varrop & Partners. And he's still a star engineer, but he's long since not been and gone. He's up and come and stayed right at the top. He's a top star engineer.
Right.
So it was interesting and good to meet him, talk bridges. And the point about this AVA footbridge, I'm still trying to get the full detail of this. I've got a phone call with Network Rail to organise and get some of the background on this. But Network Rail had a design competition a few years ago, 2018-2019, for footbridge, footbridge designs. This is both in stations and in other parts of the network where footbridges are needed, but the issue is mainly in stations, that can be off-the-shelf designs. They've got, I've got the figure somewhere here, but there are thousands of footbridges that Network Rail owns. And see if we can find it. 2,400 footbridges that Network Rail owns, providing access across the railway.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Get to the station, your train's on the other platform, you've got to walk over. And there's been an awful lot of upgrade work on these because they're trying to make it accessible for people with prams or in wheelchairs or, you know, who can't cope with the stairs. So a lot of lifts are going up.
Okay.
Lift up, walk across
passenger
the bridge,
lifts.
Lift down.
Yeah.
That's the word. So there's been a huge program of... supposedly huge. The progress has been very slow. And part of the slowness of it all is the every time somebody in Network Rail wants a new bridge, they get an architect, they can design a new bridge, please. Anyway, they do have the standard designs, and they produced a new manual. The latest edition of the manual came out just last month, I think, with off-the-shelf designs. And a couple of them, off-the-shelf designs for station bridges, came from this design competition they had in 2018-2019 called the... three, actually, the beacon, the ribbon, and the frame, and the standard types. And this is what I have yet to find out. For some reason, having done this competition, Network Rail, or maybe in tandem with this, rang up Walker Construction, who do a lot of work with the railways as a specialist contractor, and rang up Chris Wise, Expedition Engineering, and said, modern methods of construction. We need new type of railway footbridge that does ABC. It can be built quicker, more cheaply, less maintenance costs, et cetera, et cetera. And this was meant, this is how the AVA came about. It was meant to have been installed. The first one is going into Stowmarket next May. It was meant to have gone in 2 years ago. But first of all, COVID slowed it all down. And then the original steelwork fabricator went belly up. And the original steelwork fabricator, it turned out, didn't have a huge amount of experience with structures. And so really, while it made the first prototype, the issues to do with the certification process and complicated things like that. So they had to go a bit back to the drawing board to recheck everything and the certification. And they've moved it down from Market Harbour to the new steelwork fabricator in Sittingbourne, where it's on display. And they're having this this week, next week, next few weeks, a series of open days to launch, to introduce, even though it's been standing there for 2 months, they're now ready to say, ta-da, here's this bridge. It's now in the design manual for Network Rail. What's different about it, what its sale USP is or are, it's stainless steel, for one, so it doesn't need painting, much less maintenance than other types of bridges might need, you know, painting or pointing or whatever. It's a kit of parts in standard, very hard to explain the thing without a diagram, but essentially it's a Meccano kit, with standard bits. It can be, once you get everything set up on the side of the platforms, it can be all be put in a 36-hour possession.
That's really quick to
install it. So it's a big benefit. Now, if you go to the Network Rail Footbridges and Subways Design Manual, it shows the pros and cons of each type and the relative costs. For a covered bridge, the AVA is cheaper than the other three. Not by a lot. I mean, in one case, only by about £1,200. It's cheaper. Sorry, £120,000.
That's a bit different.
It's £2.64 million for this particular example that they've used in the manual versus £2.76 million for the next cheapest. Okay. For the uncovered version, it's just slightly more expensive than the next cheapest.
Okay.
But it also wins on installation time. It wins on maintenance costs and other things. To me, what the most interesting thing is the bridge design itself is quite interesting, but it's what the guy from Walker Construction, the MD there, Phil Webb, was saying, that we could make it a lot cheaper if Network Rail, instead of ordering just one bridge at a time, ordered seven or eight bridges. We could cut and handle seven bits all at the same time. We could make seven of these bridges for hugely less than seven times one bridge.
Yeah.
We can save an awful lot of money that way. He also questions some of the assumptions in the design manual about the foundation costs. He thinks the foundation costs are less expensive because it's a lighter bridge. It needs less foundations and simpler foundations. So the cost can come down further with volume.
Hmm.
But this goes back to we talked about the volumetric house builders. The problem is getting the volume. And the stumbling block that they face is the regional procurement model that Network Rail has. Network Rail, because it's all regionalised, Network Rail, whatever, Northeast, go, yeah, we want a bridge. Another bit of Network Rail 6 months later say, yeah, we want a bridge. And if it was all centrally done, centrally they could say, we want six bridges, yes, please, yeah, by, you know, next month, whatever it is. But the regional procurement model, and if that's true in bridges, it must be true of an awful lot else in Network Rail. Now, we think of devolved management as being a good thing, but sometimes centralization, and you know, maybe this is something that, you know, Rachel Reeves and Angela Rayner can take on, that bringing things to the centre and purchasing centrally, you can save a lot of money.
Mm, that's a very good point. I mean, there's been a lot of talk. Is the Labour government thinking of privatising some rail services?
But Network Rail's already, they're thinking of nationalising. They've committed to, Network Rail's already been nationalised by the Tories because of, by not because it wanted to, but not by ideology, but by necessity.
Yeah.
I mean, already some of the, I think the train operating companies are, or at least some of the train services are in the state sector. I'm not very good at, can't keep a handle on what's going on in the railways. It's always seems to be such a state of flux and mess. But yes,
Network Rail is already public sector. Yeah.
Yes.
Publicly owned. I think you're probably right. All they need to do is simplify and consolidate.
But on the subject of railways, and going back to our first topic of conversation, very interesting to see Peter Hendy, or Lord Hendy as he now is, being made Transport Minister, I think probably for railways, because he is an ex. London transport chappy. He's been chairman of Network Rail or Railtrack or one bits, you know, something, whatever the railway was when he was chair of it. I mean, he is a transport, a railways person. So they've brought in, much as they've done with being in James Timpson to be prisons minister, Starmer has gone and thought, right, who's the best person for the job? Get Hendy, bring him in. Anyway, you've asked me to write about this Avon Bridge and the Network Rail Footbridge program for a forthcoming issue of Construction.
Yes, that should be out in September. Yeah, I look forward to seeing that.
I got my July issue about 10 days ago. Very good it looked too.
Good.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, glad to hear it. Yes, we were, my comment in the beginning of the magazine was that it could be all rendered irrelevant, actually, because we had a piece about, you know, what the various political parties were offering the construction industry, and I was a little bit worried that it wouldn't land on people's desks until after the general election, but it just made it, I think.
Did you get any flack for that piece?
Not yet.
Not from Scotland?
No, well, because of the SNP. They hadn't, at the time of writing, they hadn't actually published their manifesto, so we couldn't. And anyway, nobody listens to the SNP these days, do they?
careful. Did you make that point? I didn't know. I did have a read of it. I think you perhaps ought to have said.
I've got a copy here. I can't remember what we said.
You had Plaid Cymru, but not SNP.
The funny thing was, in fact, we had this conversation after our last podcast.
Oh, yes, you did say Reform and Scottish Nationals haven't issued manifestos. Yeah, that's right. Going to press.
Yeah. Although we had I don't know if you remember the conversation we had after the last podcast. You said you did one of these questionnaires about which political party should I be voting for, and it told you that you should be voting for Plaid Cymru. Well, I did the same thing with the Telegraph, and apparently, according to if I'm most interested in, I can't remember what I've done with a piece of paper, I wrote it down somewhere, but it was quite an interesting combination. Can't remember. But anyway, the upshot was that there was no one political party that I should be voting for, because I wanted one party for their tax policies, one for their immigration policies, another one for their defence policies, and all the rest of it. And unfortunately, we didn't get the coalition that I apparently would have voted for, but there we are.
But isn't that true of all of us? I mean, even though we now have, you know, it used to be just maybe red, blue, and possible yellow parties. With the rise of Green and Reform earning substantial votes, and the nationalist parties doing well, not so well this time. With the plethora of parties comparatively that we now have, even with that, I don't think any of us absolutely fit in any particular party. You know, it's all going to be a case of hold your nose and pick the least bad option.
Well, there are plenty of people who are, you know, sort of dyed-in-the-wool Labour Party members and supporters, Tory Party members and supporters, Lib Dems, you know, and they will always stick to their ideological, you know, home, and they won't, and you know, they'll compromise, I suppose. But
yes, it might be their ideological home, but there'll be a lot of those people who identify ideologically as Labour Party supporters who would have voted, for example, for Jeremy Corbyn in Islington this
true.
Time around.
Yeah, that's true.
And others who, you know, haven't got Jeremy Corbyn to vote for would have voted for another party because they feel that the Labour Party is not the one that they traditionally belong to for whatever reason.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Ditto with all the other parties, of course.
Yes, others are available. Okay.
Anyway, at least we won't have to go through that for 5 years, I would expect. I don't think we're going to go through another period of rapid general elections, are we? I don't think.
No, not.
I think we've got a period of stability.
Well, 5 years,
I think there are going to be ructions. That by-elections will get very lively once we find out whether the Stonehenge Tunnel and the Lower Thames Crossing are going ahead and HS2 northern bit is being right. That won't happen, folks. But no, they're going to be big controversial projects which will be steamrolled through. There will be questions asked about whatever happened to local democracy and accountability. And Rachel Reeves will say, I don't care, shut up, look at the numbers, look at the economy.
Yeah. Well, that could be, yes. And they could be out of power for an awfully long time again afterwards. But we'll see.
There'll have to be a huge swing back again.
Anyway.
Right. I have nothing else to say for today, I don't think, David. Anything from you?
No, I haven't. No. Just back to the usual routine, I hope.
Well, sun's coming out. No, it's not. Right. Yes.
Right. Okay. So shall we call it a day?
Yes, call it a day. It's a day. Everyone, thank you for listening once again. Yes, please, as I said, tell us about AdBlue. David and I, David has used AdBlue. I've never touched it or smelt it, thank goodness. But what problems does it cause you? If not, why not, etc. Podcast at theconstructionindex.co.uk. And we'll be back again in 2 weeks' time when we will know whether England have won the European Championship football. And we will have... I would have said goodbye to James Anderson. I'm going to suit Lords on Saturday to say goodbye to him myself in person. So, but from David and I, it's just a temporary goodbye. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.